Welcome to Focus 580. I'm Chris Benson. In this hour, we're going to talk about, well, talk, specifically about persuasive discourse, rhetorical leadership on the issue of race. With us in the studio to help us navigate our way through this compelling topic is Kurt Wilson, McKnight Fellow and Associate Professor of Communication Studies and African American Studies at the University of Minnesota. Professor Wilson is the author of a number of articles on 19th century rhetoric surrounding the national debates on freedom and equality in both congressional and presidential branches. He also is author of an award-winning book, The Reconstruction Desegregation Debate, The Politics of Equality and the Rhetoric of Place, 1870 to 1875. He's in town to deliver a lecture tonight on Lincoln's Rhetorical Worlds, titled Debating the Great Emancipator, Lincoln's Rhetoric and Our Collective Memory. Professor Wilson, welcome to Focus 580.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's really a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you, especially since I know you flew in yesterday with all the weather we had here.
It was a bumpy flight, there's no doubt about it.
Well, glad you made it. Now, you're going to talk about Lincoln in your lecture tonight, and I should say it's scheduled at 7 p.m. in 112 Gregg Hall on campus. It's free and open to the public. So you're going to talk about Lincoln tonight, and we don't want to diminish the impact of that talk, but Lincoln does offer a point of departure for our discussion here, particularly since there's been this debate really within the past 7 or 8 years about Lincoln's place in our collective memory and whether we should remember him for the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, as a rhetorical critic and scholar, how do you assess Lincoln's rhetorical leadership on black freedom and equality?
Well, it's a wonderful question, but it's simultaneously a fairly difficult one. I think that the first thing to really appreciate is the degree to which, when we're talking about emancipation, we're actually talking about two things simultaneously. David Bryan Davis, a historian, has written a really nice essay in which he distinguishes between what he calls emancipations, which are essentially a legal act or an executive order that frees individuals who are held in bondage, and what he calls the emancipation moment. Now, the emancipation moment is distinct from the act of freeing individuals in bondage because the emancipation moment is more of a symbolic expression, a narrative, a collective memory over what the nature of that redemptive moment was like. And so what we have when we're talking about Lincoln is precisely a kind of a dual front conflict, if you will. At one level, we have the conflict over whether or not Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, for example, actually freed African Americans, even though it was limited in scope and was not exactly what we might call the most direct expression of the principles of equality, while simultaneously we have a memory of Lincoln that really characterizes him as being the great emancipator.
And some recent commentators have talked a great deal about that. Lerone Bennett, in particular, former executive editor of Ebony Magazine, who has some very strong views about Lincoln in that regard.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think it was in 1968, Bennett wrote an essay that appeared in Ebony when he essentially questioned whether or not Lincoln was ever committed to black equality. In the year 2000, he's written a book that deals specifically with the notion that Lincoln was, quote, forced into glory. And what he argues in that text is that Lincoln was fundamentally a racist, and that not only was he a racist, but that everything he did with respect to African Americans was either A, forced upon him by circumstances that he was trying to avoid, or B, was actually done in an effort to rid the United States of African Americans completely for the benefit of whites.
Now, you talk about this in the context of the paradox of Lincoln. Tell us a little more about that. There's sort of this pragmatic political take on his position that a number of scholars have set out.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of historians, Gulzo, for example, Harold Holzer, G.S. Borrett, who have argued that actually Lincoln was very interested in emancipating African Americans and that he was committed to equality, but that he could only do it by essentially placating aspects of the South and especially the loyal border states, while simultaneously working within the limits of the Constitution. Now, the paradox arrives in the sense, at least from my standpoint, that ironically, something like the Emancipation Proclamation, which on its surface, when you read it, does not seem to be a particularly strong articulation of freedom for African Americans. In fact, it legally did very little to free African Americans with respect to any place other than the area that was not under his direct control, that actually becomes a means by which he appeals to African Americans in the South, encouraging them, if you will, to escape slavery, cross the Union lines, and actually engage with him in the prosecution of the war.
And there's some language that that I think Lerone Bennett draws on from Lincoln that gives some strength to that argument. But I want to just say right now for our listeners that we are taking calls, and locally you can call us at 333-9455 and long distance 1-800-222-9455. Locally again, that's 333-9455, long distance 1-800-222-9455, and we invite you to join our discussion. Now, we're sort of smack dab in the middle of the 150th anniversary of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. They started in August of 1858, ended in October. And during the Ottawa debate against Stephen Douglas, Lincoln said the following: "I have no purpose to introduce political and social equality between the white and the black races. There is a physical difference between the two, which in my judgment will probably forever forbid their living together upon the footing of perfect equality. But I hold that notwithstanding all natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but hold notwithstanding all this, there is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all these rights." So how do we explain that? That split in the context of the times, which is how some scholars have seen it, in terms of the pragmatism that you talked about, and how is it that Lerone Bennett may have gotten it wrong in looking at that on its face, on the value of the words themselves, and drawing his conclusions?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's clear. And in fact, Stephen Douglas tried to prosecute pretty heavily during the debates Lincoln precisely on this issue, arguing that Lincoln would often say one thing in the South when he was debating and another thing entirely when he was in the North debating.
That sounds so familiar.
Doesn't it, though? Yeah, we haven't come too far removed from those kinds of accusations. I think there's several ways to explain it. I am persuaded by the argument of Borton as well as others that often when Lincoln viewed the Declaration of Independence, he fundamentally believed that it applied to every individual, but that he simultaneously understood the Declaration of Independence as being fairly limited in its scope, and specifically limited to the economic opportunities that citizens might have in this country. In fact, Lincoln will say in another debate that he espouses quite specifically the fact that even though African Americans and European Americans might not be equal in every respect, at least not in color, and it's odd that he would choose color in that moment as a point of inequality, he says that in the right to earn the results of their own labor, in the right to earn the money to feed themselves, they are the equal under the Declaration of Independence to every other citizen. And based upon that notion, we get to understand from this particular period a principle called limited absolute equality.
And sort that out for us so that we're clear on what that term suggests.
Yeah, I think limited absolute equality essentially articulates the idea that all citizens of the United States exist in an absolute equality with one another, but that equality is limited specifically to economic and certain legal rights as opposed to what's later and during this particular time period going to be known as social rights.
Right. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, particularly when we get into the Reconstruction debates on desegregation, because the Democrats drew some power from that argument and certainly set that point out. But before we get to that, what about the Emancipation Proclamation? You suggested that it wasn't necessarily the strongest document in sorting out the moral authority equality for African Americans. It basically set out as a legal document emancipation. And of course, there's the argument that it really didn't have any legal effect. But
yeah, no. Well, what's interesting is that when we talk about the Emancipation Proclamation, we are in essence talking about two different documents. We're talking about one called the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, which Lincoln issues prior to the point at which he does the Emancipation Proclamation that we're all familiar with. And if you put the two documents together, what you begin to appreciate is the degree to which the documents themselves are a persuasive act. They're an attempt to persuade the Southern states to perhaps end the rebellion and in return for ending the rebellion, potentially keep their slaves. The documents are quite specific that Lincoln has no intention, at that moment at least, of freeing African Americans held in bondage in those territories, in those states, in those areas that are directly under the control of the Union Army. However, he is willing and does, on January 1st of 1863, issue a proclamation that essentially frees all of those slaves that exist within the Confederacy itself.
Mm-hmm. Where he has no authority.
Yeah, that's the argument. And what's kind of funny is that, I use the word funny perhaps too lightly there. What's interesting is that to a delegation of Quakers that he met with several months prior to that particular point in the summer of 1862, Lincoln actually says to them at their request to please issue an Emancipation Proclamation. He says, why should I issue a proclamation to the southern states freeing all of the slaves when the southern states won't even listen to the Constitution?
Well, keeping it on the subject here of rhetorical leadership, where is the leadership that Lincoln we would hope was exerting with respect to his words? We don't see it necessarily in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. We don't see it at all in the Emancipation Proclamation, unless, of course, we consider the proclamation itself a statement. Is that how we should see it?
Well, I think that leadership is exercised in several different ways. In other words, those who really defend, historians as well as others who defend Lincoln's status as the great emancipator, argue that he was caught in an extremely difficult political position as well as constitutional position, and that much of what seems to be hesitating language is in fact surprisingly forceful language. It is leading the country slowly and surely towards the position where they come to understand that the war should be about freedom and not just simply about union. Frederick Douglass himself, not too long after the death of Abraham Lincoln, seems to express precisely this position when he argues that judged by the sentiments of the people and of the times, while he might have seemed tardy, he was in fact rigorous and aggressive. But I think that one of the things I want to talk about later this evening during my lecture is a slightly different interpretation of what we might call rhetorical leadership. And that is that even in those moments when Lincoln seems to be hesitating, what he is fundamentally doing is trying to engage the country in a dialogue. He is trying to get slaveholders. He is trying to get Congress. He is trying to get free African Americans. Eventually, he appeals directly to the slaves themselves to really grapple as a country with the problem of slavery. And I think that that was actually one of the most remarkable aspects of his presidency, that for him, rhetorical leadership is sometimes trying to bring others to the table to engage in dialogue and help them resolve the issues themselves.
And that certainly was the intent, but what was the effect at the time?
Well,
we're going to talk about the collective memory, but
yeah, at the time it was one of rejection. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, almost everyone rejected Lincoln's appeals to come to the table and have a conversation. It's quite clear that the South rejected his appeal with respect to let's come to the table and have a conversation before secession. Mm-hmm. It seems as though Congress at times rejected his advice with respect to compensated emancipation and gradual emancipation in the District of Columbia. The loyal states, the loyal border states, as they're typically referred to, tended to reject his proposals that they consider compensated gradual emancipation. And so perhaps for some of those reasons I've argued elsewhere, Lincoln begins to turn directly to a new audience, that of African Americans held in bondage.
And of course, in our collective memory, that's what people tend to associate with Lincoln, that there's more meaning to the words with respect to full equality than there really was. Of course, we've had this reassessment more recently when people are taking a more critical look. But how did we arrive at that that impression of Lincoln?
Oh, you know what?
The initial one.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's happened surprisingly quickly. The reality is that while I think historians are correct to say that there was a great deal of criticism of Abraham Lincoln during the period of his presidency, it's also the case that already there were the beginnings before his assassination of people who believed he was a phenomenal president, an excellent president, and a president who was doing just truly amazing work. There are two lithographs that I really like, both of which are published by NAST, and I believe they appeared in Harper's Weekly. One is published in 1863, as I recall. The other is published in 1865. And both of them purport to display emancipation In the middle of the lithograph, in the middle of this image, there is a quiet African-American home scene where the family is gathered around a hearth and the father and the mother are cuddling their children. On the left hand of this particular lithograph are images of slavery, whipping, the slavery of human individuals as expressed in their sale, a whole host of really horrific, iconic images. On the right-hand side are images of peace and prosperity for African Americans, little children going off to school, for example, and black laborers earning wages. Now, in the first image, in 1863, that's what you see. By 1865, at the bottom of the image, Abraham Lincoln's face is incorporated into the image itself. And there we begin to see what essentially, over the course of the next 20, 30, 40 years, the real memory of Abraham Lincoln as the great emancipator. And I might mention that even individuals like Frederick Douglass, I think, had some things to gain by articulating Lincoln in that manner, because so long as the country was willing to appreciate Lincoln for being the great emancipator, at least the issue of black freedom and black equality remained as an important point of public debate.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting because even in the one lithograph you described, there is this status of African Americans certainly enjoying equal rights, but in a separate context.
Yes, exactly.
And that is what Lincoln articulated, at least suggested. I'd be interested in hearing what you think about the hypothetical if Lincoln had lived. if Lincoln had lived. Where would he have been situated in the Reconstruction debate? I mean, because now the North has won, and we're considering what kind of country this is going to be. I mean, this is I don't think people really fully appreciate what an extraordinary moment this was. But where would he have been in this discourse?
That is a great question. I mean, the traditional interpretation of Lincoln's position at the end of his life with respect to Reconstruction is that he probably was leaning towards the lenient position. That is, he was anxious to bring the Southern states back into union as quickly as possible, that he ascribed to the constitutional perspective that suggested that they had never really left the Union to begin with, that quite frankly, leaving the Union was an impossibility under his particular interpretation of the Constitution, and for those reasons, it was just really a matter of reincorporating them. Some more recent scholarship has suggested, however, that Lincoln was really being influenced pretty heavily by some radicals in Congress, most certainly Charles Sumner, who spent a lot of time talking with Lincoln, but in addition, Thaddeus Stevens and some others, and that perhaps what is perceived to be Lincoln's supposed lenience or potential lenience with respect to Reconstruction and with respect to the Confederate states might actually have been a much harder line than what we would have anticipated. You know, I don't know precisely what Lincoln's position would have been, but I do think that it's reasonable to presume that just as he had during his entire presidency, he would have wanted a dialogue. He would have wanted all of the interested parties to come together and talk. And the thing that, at least for me, is the most encouraging about Abraham Lincoln is that at least by 1863 and 1864, he's finally come to recognize that blacks deserve a voice at the table as well.
Hmm. Still a separate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that leads to the next question. Of course, his words did survive. But as we review your work and the work of so many others, we don't really see a lot of strong moral arguments that are framed in the context of what Lincoln might have said or what Lincoln might have thought or what he might have wanted. It seems that the discourse has moved beyond him. Mm-hmm. Is that a correct, a fair assessment? At least the Democrats, certainly, and we're going to get to that.
Yeah, I mean, that is somewhat true. But one of the things that's also clear during the Reconstruction is that everyone seems pretty anxious to seem as though they're the children of Lincoln, right? Everyone, even those who are clearly white supremacist, are arguing that Lincoln understood the limitations, they would argue, of African Americans. So while it is true that I think they move beyond it and they find their own voice, it's also the case that Lincoln still remains, perhaps as a haunting ghost or a specter, if you will, during at least much of that debate.
Well, you let's talk about the debates.
Okay.
You set it out as basically a discourse in three voices.
Mm-hmm.
The first is the voice of the obviously the racist elements, the
sure.
sort of radical Democrats.
Yeah, I believe I call them unrepentant.
Yes, and fire eaters. You have a lot of language in describing them. But these are people who basically rely on the culture of the time, which is an extraordinary period, as I mentioned, a period in which separation was institutionalized, not just in the law, but in the culture, in religion, in certainly this pseudoscience of ethnology, racial and mm-hmm. ethnic difference. Mm-hmm. And you write about this as a fundamental conflict between the politics of equality and the ideology of place.
Mm-hmm.
How does that figure into this debate, this discourse?
Well, I think that the notion, the ideology of equality is something that Eric Fona and others have argued really was an issue with some salience as well as some potential political effect during the Reconstruction period. There are individuals who are arguing, perhaps sometimes for selfish reasons, that is, that they wanted African Americans, for example, to get the right to vote so that the Republican Party could remain in ascendancy during that particular period. But they simultaneously, and perhaps not even contradictorily, believed that African Americans deserved that right, that they had most certainly, due to their war record, just done a tremendous job over the course of the Civil War, and simultaneously had proven themselves worthy citizens. And that notion of ideology, that ideology, if you will, of equality, I think did play an important role in many of the debates in the time period. So what ended up happening is that those who wanted to continue segregation, who wanted not only to have blacks and whites separate, if you will, not only in public accommodations and restaurants and hotels and public schools and cemeteries, jury boxes, but just as importantly, what they wanted to do is remain and maintain the places, which was, of course, a hierarchical placing of European Americans versus African Americans. What they began to do is they began to grapple with this question of, okay, how can we simultaneously deal with this notion of equality while also reinforcing, if you will, this difference, the segregated spacing, and this hierarchical arrangement of place?
Which is all about power.
Exactly.
Maintaining the power
exactly.
hierarchy. Well, I want to get back to that in just a moment, but I do want to invite listeners to call in at 333-9455 or long distance 1-800-222-9455. And we're talking with Professor Kurt Wilson, a rhetorical critic and scholar on the construction of race through rhetorical leadership, or sometimes, I guess, a lack of leadership. We'll mm-hmm. get to that as well. But right now we have a call on from Champaign County.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Good morning.
Lerone Bennett spoke here on campus, and I also had a chance to see him. I read his book quite a while ago. It's actually a bestseller by mm-hmm. standards in the African-American community, and I found it extremely persuasive. About 5 years ago, the Lincoln Scholars invited him to go to the old State House in Springfield on Lincoln's birthday and defend his thesis, and papers were presented. I don't know. I assume that's probably in the record somewhere.
It is, yeah.
I attended that, and the salience I remember from that, the discourse here at the U of I was very persuasive, too. It's very heretical, obviously, too. But the one little item that really has lodged in my mind is Bennett's documentation that Lincoln defied the radical Republican Congress he had and kept funding going to the Indian removal, I guess they called it the Negro Removal Office.
Yeah, colonization.
It was sort of patterned on the Indian Removal Act in some ways, and this was part of in the context of Marcus Garvey wanting to lead African Americans back to Africa to the extent that he even was talking with the Ku Klux Klan to help engineer it. Apparently, that's been raised too, and that's a bit of a digression, but. The context of the time is that apparently Lincoln, you know, accepted the personhood of African Americans, but not here. That there was racial identity was tied to, you know, the soil, and that it was important to, you know, I don't know if cleanse is the right word, but send them back to where they were could be fully human or something, as opposed to here where they would always be the conflict or something. There's a lot of resonances there, but But the fact that people talk about Lincoln's defying constitutional order in a number of regards, but actually diverting funds against the radical Republican Congress's will to fund this office is like I say, it's stuck in my mind that I think that more people of all hues should read Lerone Bennett and seriously take the argument.
Yeah. Well, thank you, caller. And certainly we should look at all the commentators out there. And what do you think about that? There's an interesting point, certainly, that Bennett raises in answer to those people who say, well, look, we need to consider Lincoln in his time, in the context of the time, and consider that his approach was nuanced, that it was a pragmatic response to the social political system that he was dealing with. And Lerone Bennett says, "Well, wait a minute. What about the Republicans, the abolitionists, the people who were out there taking risks and leading the charge for full equality?"
Well, I understand precisely what the caller is suggesting, and I think that there is no doubt that one of the most disturbing elements of Abraham Lincoln's administration is his position with respect to colonization. The fact is that Lincoln had been a proponent of colonization for some time. One of his political heroes, Henry Clay, was really into colonization. Lincoln had expressed his support of the notion of colonization prior to coming into office, and while he was in office, he did secure funding for perhaps a colonization investigation as well as the act itself. He certainly had several correspondents. We've got records of his correspondence with individuals that were proposing various schemes, if you will, to emigrate African Americans once they had been freed, and some who were already free. The defenders of Lincoln's position on this particular issue argue the following two, and let me be clear. I'm not necessarily saying that these are more persuasive than Bennett's arguments, but as a rhetorician, as someone who's interested in argument, it's interesting to, if you will, put the arguments next to one another on the same page and see how they play out. Those who support Lincoln said, first of all, that when it came to colonization, he was always for voluntary colonization, that he did not express the position that African Americans would be forced to leave the country, that he, in fact, left it to their choice whether they would do so or not. And though so from that standpoint, the argument at least has been made by some historians, he's actually no different from some early black nationalists of the 19th century. The second argument that's often made with respect to colonization is that Lincoln needed that particular argument to keep the border states in particular in line as he slowly moved the country as a whole toward the position of emancipation, that the border states were unlikely to stay with the Union if they came to believe that not only would emancipation transpire, but that the administration would have no interest in securing the jobs, the prospects of whites in this country in their potential competition with African Americans. Now, what I think is interesting from my standpoint is something else that the caller mentioned, and if I could, I'd just like to speak to that briefly. And that's the fact that Bennett's book itself has been widely, and I think to a certain extent, warmly received by the general public. That is, there are several instances I've heard of, for example, when Bennett is giving a speech in Harlem at the Schomburg Center for Research, in which in the process of presenting some of the information from his book, he receives quite a bit of applause, quite a bit of adulation. But simultaneously, within at least many corners of the historical establishment with respect to Lincoln, the book is looked at pretty suspiciously. There's not many professional historians who concentrate on Lincoln who really go along with all of Bennett's thesis. They agree with some of his facts, but they don't necessarily agree with his interpretations of those facts.
And but there are scholars who agree with some of the premises as well, particularly the whole notion of the duality of Lincoln's position with respect to freedom on the one hand and full equality on the other, which is what I want to seg to, because the black lawmakers during this period certainly weren't thinking about moving out of this country. Mm-hmm. They wanted to stay. They felt invested, as you've suggested, especially those who had been former slaves. And they had quite a challenge in overcoming the overwhelming culture of the country at the time, not just to pose arguments, to be advocates, but also to represent in a way. And you talk about that in the book as well. This whole notion of the argument, the confrontation, even with their fellow congressmen, which was obviously a very important thing to be able to engage in the discourse on the floor of Congress, to establish your equality with the strength of your intellect, your argument.
Yeah. Well, Charles Sumner, as early as 1872, as I recall, begins introducing into Congress several pieces of legislation, including one that would have essentially desegregated all public accommodations, including public schools, jury spaces, hotels, stagecoaches, trains, the entire gamut of public accommodations that we think of today. And that particular debate rages in Congress until 1875, when it's finally passed in a modified form as the 1875 Civil Rights Act. What's really interesting, however, is that in 1874 and 1875, as Congress is debating that particular measure, whether or not, quite explicitly, African Americans are sufficiently equal to occupy the same spaces of whites in our public accommodation spaces, that there are African Americans in Congress, individuals like Robert Elliott, James Rapier, Alonzo Rensier, a number of other congressmen, who are explicitly arguing, ironically as this may seem, that even though they are members of Congress, they now should also have the right to be in a first-class carriage as they go from point A to point B. And what's fascinating about this is that it brings them into direct conflict. I mean, the scene itself is just so dramatic. It brings them into direct conflict to those voices that remain unrepentant with respect to the antebellum period. And you have instances in which an African-American congressman stands up and objects to something that a Southern white Democrat is saying, someone who's of the more fire eater capacity, and the European American says, "Sit down! I do not recognize you. I will not listen to your arguments."
I'm talking to gentlemen.
Exactly, I'm talking to gentlemen, not to you. And in that moment, you see explicitly the revolution, quite literally, that's going on in the United States of America, where a black congressman is objecting to something that a white congressman is saying, and the white congressman doesn't even want to recognize his right to object, because that in and of itself grants agency. Right. It grants precisely the kind of equality that these individuals were arguing they should have, not only in Congress, but throughout the country.
Making arguments and in a confrontational way on the floor of Congress that they obviously couldn't even do in their home districts in the South.
Yeah, exactly right.
With ordinary people, let alone congressmen. Well, that gets back to the point I was making earlier about the three discursive voices that you referred to in the book that emerged during the course of this period as we're discussing desegregation, and those basically are the white supremacy and black inferiority voice. Those people on the radical radical Democrats, as you also call them, the fire eaters. There's also the black voice that comes up in the equality prong of your discussion with the Republicans, who are arguing obviously for inclusion, and then finally the moderate Democrats. Let's talk a little bit about those fire eaters. These are unrepentant voices, as you've discussed them, who rely on the status quo as an empowerment for their arguments. This is the way it is. This is the way it always has been. This is the way it should continue to be. Not even separate but equal, but just separate.
Yeah, just separate and unequal. Yeah, these voices clearly remain part of a culture and a set of ideology of white supremacy that they argued was fundamentally grounded in divine right, for lack of a better word. This is the way God has willed it to be, that individuals of color are inherently not only subservient but also the servants of those of us who are the more quote-unquote advanced races.
But by this time, how much weight does that argument really carry?
Well, that's precisely the interesting thing. At least in Congress, it's not carrying the day, right? In other words, there's a sense in which I think those arguments can still be expressed, for instance, in state politics. Those arguments can most certainly be expressed in county politics throughout the Reconstruction era. But in the Congress itself, in the nation's capital, it has become inappropriate to make those kinds of arguments. And it's inappropriate for several reasons. First, because of the Civil War. because of the war that has just been fought, the loss of blood, and how Lincoln himself had reoriented by the end of the war, especially, for example, in his second inaugural, what it was the war was about. But secondly, I think the very presence of these African-American congressmen make those kinds of arguments increasingly difficult to make. I mean, when Robert Elliott stands up and gives one of the best speeches of the entire debate, a speech that individuals are lined up to hear, and after he gives it, give him a tremendous roar of applause, the notion of African-American inequality and inferiority is busted wide open.
It's equality by enactment.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. And so for those reasons, that more explicitly white supremacist position is untenable, at least in the halls of Congress.
Yeah, because they're demonstrating their equality just being there.
Absolutely.
The second prong, the equality voice, has basically, I guess, three parts. One represented largely by Charles Sumner, whom you describe as a prophet. It's really amazing to review his rhetoric. And to see him setting out arguments that that foreshadow arguments of the 20th century, you know, the whole notion that that race is a social construct, the notion that separate but equal is unequal. These are arguments that are going to come up, you know, 75 years or more down the road. Tell us a little bit about the force of his rhetoric and what impact it had.
Well, Charles Sumner was a very interesting and in many respects a fairly controversial figure throughout his tenure in politics. He began his term in Congress, as I recall, as a conscience Whig, which meant that he was part of the Whig Party, but he was part of that Whig Party that really favored abolition. He was friends with many of the transcendentalists and the abolitionists of that particular time period, constantly corresponding with them. There's at one point in the historical, in the historiography, a great debate, should we call Charles Sumner an abolitionist or not? Because after all, he was a politician and all politicians have to compromise at some juncture on principle. And even Sumner did. But what was remarkable about Sumner's career is that despite his fairly eccentric nature and an oratory that quite frankly harkened back to the classical traditions of Cicero, which was becoming increasingly seen as laborious and overblown, if you will, by this point in the 19th century, Sumner was really consistent on his equality position with respect to African Americans. He opposes the 14th Amendment at one juncture because he doesn't believe that it's radical enough. He opposes the 15th Amendment, or at least speaks out against it at one point, in large measure because he believes that African Americans have the right to vote now that they're citizens, and that to try and pass additional amendments to give them that right is to somehow minimize the citizenship that they have. And so as an individual of this particular period, a white man, he really did articulate a kind of equality that was really useful. It's important to recognize, too, that he had friends in the African-American community who respected that position and would often use his arguments, but they were certainly not beholden to that position either. Mm. They were willing to make their own arguments and push the argument even further by saying, Sumner says this with respect to principle. I say this with respect to practicality.
and the whole notion that they had earned it.
Exactly right. You
know, obviously contributing to the economy.
Exactly right.
But also participating in all the sacred wars of the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's precisely the position that many of these African-American congressmen make. It's fine to talk about equality in principle, but we have earned this right. We have demonstrated our loyalty. When the South was disloyal, we were loyal.
and as far back as the Revolution, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely.
And so Benjamin Butler adds some weight to that prong. He's a former general, former Union general, mm-hmm. and he testifies at this really dramatic moment on the floor of Congress about his observations of the black troops in battle. And it's a really, really moving narrative. I'm not going to take up our time in reading that now, but I'll describe it. He places the audience right there in the scene in his descriptive narrative of the bloody battle and watching the African American troops, you know, sacrifice and the bravery that they demonstrated on the field. And it was so moving because he was able to transform the memory at that point, the collective memory of the experience. Up to that point, the country hadn't really celebrated African American contributions to in battle, But he's setting it out there and actually putting people in the scene. What kind of impact do you think that had in terms of that moment?
No, I think it had tremendous impact. You know, some of my friends have sometimes called me a discourse geek. That is, that I like to go back to, the Congressional Record and even earlier the Congressional Globe and look back at these speeches that were given throughout the 19th century. And yes, they're old and yes, they're musty, but it's so amazing the degree to which they have such drama. They have such life. And the speech that you're referring to by Butler is a remarkable text. It really is. I mean, there is a virtual experience. He paints the picture for his audience to such a degree that when he says that he had to be careful with his horse's hooves, that they not, as they walked through this sea of black bodies that had sacrificed their blood and their life for the good of the country, he did not want his horse's hooves to profane what was for him sacred ground. That kind of discourse really, I think, had a tremendous impact. And I think I can back that up. I can back that up because another historian that a lot of people are reading and really excited about, called Blight, has talked a great deal about memories of the Civil War and reconciliation. And one of the things that Blight argues, and I think quite persuasively, is that African Americans' blood and sacrifice is eventually read out of the Civil War conflict by the end of the 19th century, that slowly but surely the contributions that these black soldiers had made disappears, at least from some parts, shall we say the mainstream, of public collective memory about the Civil War. And instead what we have is the white Union soldier and the white Confederate soldier and the African-American soldier disappears from the scene. What I think is that's so telling, and it's telling precisely because of the power that that sacrifice ensured.
Blacks sacrificed on an equal basis with whites, and that established the equality. We're talking with Professor Kurt Wilson. The number is 333-9455, and we do have a call from Champaign County. No, I guess we don't. Okay. There was a third prong that you discussed, the third voice, moderate Democrats, who actually in some ways seem to have influenced the popular thought at that point by picking up on a strain of Lincoln's rhetoric and asserting that, yeah, okay, we acknowledge black equality on certain levels, but not on the social level. You discussed that a little bit earlier.
Yeah, the moderate Democrats, I think a good example of this is Alexander Stevens, for example, vice president of the Confederacy, now a representative from Georgia by the early 1870s. His position and that position of the voice that during the big debate over desegregation I call the moderate Democratic voice essentially was that, okay, we fought a war, we resolved the conflict, slavery is gone, and that's a key. That really is a key. For these individuals, they fundamentally wanted to argue and made the claim slavery has been abolished. And it's important because what they wanted to point out is that there's a rupture. There's a change. The old social power system is no longer intact, was their claim. I don't personally agree with it, but that was the claim, that with slavery gone, the old social order is also gone. And we have, they argued, legal equality and political equality for African Americans. What they said they did not want to see is social equality. What they argued they were not prepared for, and they argued that the whites of the South were not prepared for, was social equality. And the way that they interpreted or defined social equality is, again, quite literally, African Americans and European Americans occupying the same physical material spaces under the auspices of equal rights and equal authority.
And they set the tone for the Jim Crow system that we experience in this country for years to come.
Yeah, absolutely.
The 50s and the Civil Rights Movement. I just want to fast forward to that because I do want to touch on a couple of other things. One, certainly King and the power of his rhetoric. And you've written about a definitive moment at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement when Rosa Parks has taken her stand in Montgomery by holding onto her seat. And there's an organizational meeting, that first meeting at Holt Street Baptist Church. And King, in a brilliant and inspired moment, sort of redefines Rosa Parks. Now, she's been sort of a militant up to this point. She's trained.
Yeah, she's had training in what we might call indirect and direct action.
But in a way, he single-handedly transformed her into this this icon, this spiritual icon, this passive player in this this whole scenario.
Yeah, he does that in a variety of cases through the course of the Montgomery bus boycott. You can see it most particularly, for example, in the Holt Street Address, which is one of the more famous speeches that King gives during that particular conflict, very, very early, right at the beginning of the conflict. You can see it in a variety of newspaper testimonies that he and others are giving during this particular period. And what you have, essentially, is the transformation of Rosa Parks from an engaged, working-class black woman who had an interest in and received training in political agitation. She is transformed into far more of a motherly figure with a religious orientation who is pious and wants nothing more than just simply to be afforded the rights and opportunities that others have. Now let me be clear. I think, as is so often true with rhetoric, it's not as though one version is right and the other version is necessarily wrong. It is instead, as the power of discourse so often comes to bear, that it's what you emphasize that comes to define the very things that you're discussing.
Hmm. And we can see that in the contemporary moment as well, can't we? Barack Obama has been compared to King. Do you think that's a fair comparison with respect to his oratory?
Sure. I think it's a fair comparison. It depends on what the comparison is trying to establish, right? If the comparison is trying to establish the idea that somehow their eloquence is equal, then I'm not sure that that's really the best type of comparison one can make. If the comparison, because I think they're quite different, if the comparison is instead that they both understand the power of oratory to inspire hope, to transform minds, and to actually create a common identity for the American people that includes whites and blacks, then absolutely, I think the comparison is worthy.
I want to come back to that. We're taking calls at 333-9455, and we have a call now from Urbana.
Yes, good morning. It still is. I know we're on short time. If you be such a good fellow and take up the question of Abraham Lincoln and the Native Americans, after all, he did order the largest mass execution in American history in the state of Minnesota of Blackfeet and Sioux tribal leaders and a few other tribes. And because it's a large question, I'll hang up and let you answer. Thank you.
Well, I really appreciate that question. I actually teach at the University of Minnesota, and that particular hanging is in fact something that is an important part of some of the courses that I teach there. And I'll be honest, I'm not entirely sure how to answer the question. At one level, I think that Abraham Lincoln's record with respect to Native Americans is abysmal. It is clear that his position with respect to property and territories is such that he is more interested in putting the interests of the European American community first with respect to who should occupy those territories and what should be done. There are some individuals who argue that while it is true that particular moment of capital punishment is perhaps the largest that has ever taken place. Not perhaps, it is the largest that has ever taken place in American history, that Lincoln actually commuted the sentences of a number of individuals at that precise moment, and that it could have been even larger, but that he didn't go as far as he might have. So I am not one of those individuals, quite frankly, though, who wants to try and find something redemptive or good in the Lincoln administration as a whole with respect to its record on Indian rights.
Thank you, caller. We have a few minutes left, and we can still take calls at 333-9455 or long distance at 1-800-222-9455, and we're talking with Professor Kurt Wilson. Coming back into this contemporary consideration with Barack Obama, you know, it's really interesting and ironic that his gift, his oratorical gift, in some ways is being used against him. And I'm wondering how we sort that out within the consideration, and just with a couple of minutes left, consideration of this whole notion of the rhetoric of place. I mean, that in some ways he is stepping out of his place and even running for president. And so, you know, there's so much coded language that we're hearing now in trying to situate him outside of the normal American experience. How do you see that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I need to be upfront about my biases here. I mean, I'm a student of rhetoric. I am fascinated by political rhetoric, and I'm for those reasons really attracted to some of the discourse that Barack Obama articulates. That said, I do find it astonishing. I do find it really astonishing that an individual who leads through discourse, who leads through rhetoric, would then somehow be characterized as someone who doesn't have leadership skill. I mean, it's clear, and I think that the presidency of Ronald Reagan himself demonstrates it, that the American public can be led through visions and policies and discourse that allow them to see themselves in terms that are different from what they traditionally have. And I think that Barack Obama has done that quite remarkably. I do consider it an amazing act of leadership.
We are going to be watching that. We have another call that we can take quickly. We have less than a minute left. And yes, caller.
Hello. I'd like to give this to Professor Wilson. Going back to the Lerone Bennett, I find that Abraham Lincoln, he did what every other politician that we find does. He did the best he could, I feel, under the circumstances and the political environment. I mean, when we talk about Douglas,
We have just a few seconds left.
Douglas and Salmon P. Chase and other people of that time, I think that there were issues with them as well. And John F. Kennedy. He wasn't signing the Civil Rights Act. It took Lyndon Johnson with all of his baggage to do it. So
yeah.
I think in fairness, Abraham Lincoln did help us in many ways.
Thank you, caller. Yeah. We're going to have a quick response.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the caller's comments, and I think that that's quite true. You know what? I mean, fundamentally, what excites me the most about being a rhetorical theorist and critic is the fact that rhetoric is the means by which we take those really difficult contingent moments and try to come with some certainty that results in judgment. And I do think that Lincoln attempted to do precisely that.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Kurt Wilson. And we're looking forward to your talk. Obviously, we can go on for hours on this. But tonight at 7 p.m., 112 Gregory Hall on campus, free and open to the public. We look forward to your talk, and we really appreciate you joining us today here.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.